Thank you, Leah. It's very nice. And good afternoon. Boy, it's light. I feel like you're on TV or something. I'd like you to turn to Luke 15, if you would. Luke chapter 15. And we're going to spend the sermon time in this part, not in Luke 15, but that's where we're going to start. And I know some other messages of this period of this part of Luke's narrative, which is the travel narrative, it's called. You know, when he, chapter 9? Let's see if I can find it. Chapter 9 and verse 51, it came to pass when the time was come that that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. And so from here all the way to his crucifixion from chapter 9, Luke presents these messages as being shared with people on his way to Jerusalem or in Jerusalem. And it's called the travel narrative. And in Luke 15, in the first few verses there, up to verse 7, we read about the man has 100 sheep, and he loses one, and he looks for the one that's lost, and how much joy there is over that. So it's one of these lost and found type parables. And there's one that follows it right after that in verse 8. The woman has 10 pieces of silver. She loses one. Doesn't she light a candle, sweep the house until she finds it? Then when she finds it, she calls her friends and her neighbors together, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I found that which was lost." So we have this theme going in chapter 15. And then from verses 11 down to the end of the chapter, you have the story of the prodigal son, which is a combination, I think, of that lost theme, you know, where the son is lost and then he's found. It's also it brings in the concept or the additional element of a very merciful and loving father that's involved. And, of course, the types are obvious. And we've gone, I'm sure you've heard sermons on that before, whether here locally or wherever. Now, the reason I mentioned chapter 15 is I'd like to go into chapter 16. And I'd like you to imagine that there's no chapter break there because that's artificial. And it's just as, you know, when Luke wrote this scroll or compiled this from his sources, because he wasn't an eyewitness, he gathered these things together and he put them in a certain order for a certain reason. And we're going to talk about something in chapter 16 today, and I'd like you to imagine, for purposes of understanding the context, that there's no chapter break, and that perhaps Luke intended that we read what he has in chapter 16 in the same context as the parables there in chapter 15. I can't prove that that's the case. I just want you to consider that. It may help to explain the parable that we begin to read about there in chapter 16 about the unjust steward. You know, what if there wasn't a chapter break? How might this affect the way you have viewed the parable of the unjust steward? That's what we're going to look into today, the parable of the unjust steward. It's a tough one. I've used this resource before, this Klein Snodgrass book on the parables, the stories with intent. He's got a huge chapter on it and basically says, you know, nobody agrees. There are lots of different interpretations. I don't know what yours is. I'm not sure what mine was. I had ideas. And I'm still, by the time we get done the sermon here, you still won't know you'll know which way I lean, but I'm not going to stand up here and claim that I have the answers when there's plenty of smart people that have looked at this long before I did. That had difficulty coming up with answers. Let's first, before we talk any more about it, let's just read it. Luke chapter 16, beginning in verse 1. And he said this, I'm reading from the King James today. He said this to his disciples. There was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused to him that he had wasted his goods. And he called him and he said to him, "How is it that I hear this of you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you may no longer be steward." And then the steward said to himself, "Well, what shall I do? For my Lord takes away from me the stewardship. I can't dig. To beg, I am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their homes." Excuse me. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors to him. He said to the first, "How much do you owe?" unto my lord, and he said 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. And then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said, take your bill and write 80. Then the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. I'll read verse 9 too, but there's already an issue with the interpretation of this parable because people don't agree on when the parable ends. Does it end with the beginning of verse 8, the end of verse 8, or does it end with verse 9? Let's read verse 9. I say to you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, so that when they fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Some people, Klein Snodgrass is one, says the parable ends with verse 9. If you don't include verse 9, it doesn't make sense to him. Kenneth Bailey, got two of his books here, he says it ends at verse 8. And Klein Snodgrass will give you lots of quotes many other researchers, many other scholars, many other New Testament scholars that have varying degrees of feeling about where this parable ends. So I don't think it's cut and dried. If you think it is, that's fine. I don't have a firm answer. I know which way I lean. If verse 9 is included, it has a lot to say about what the parable is about. If it's not included, the parable could be about something else and more along the lines of chapter 15. And that's what I'm going to spend more time with today. Okay, we briefly read over this parable. What is it about this parable that may make it somewhat difficult to interpret or may make it somewhat tough for a Christian to say, this is an example of what our Savior teaches? What is it there that might be difficult? Yes?
Sort of being forgiving to other people, but it's really the selfish way of doing that from the beginning.
So the steward is being selfish, okay. And in what way does that make the parable difficult to...
Because that's not a godly trait to follow.
Okay, perhaps he's being commended for doing something that's not so good.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else ever want to comment? I think that's the gist of it. That's a problem. In the parable, the way Luke wrote it down, he's called, and is it verse 8? He calls him an unjust steward in the King James. So here's a guy that's I put up here, rascal. I got that from Kenneth Bailey, that's not my word. He's a rascal. He's a crook. He's unjust. And it says the Lord commended him, complimented him. Well, that's a problem, or can be a problem. How do you view that? Excuse me. How do we answer that? There were people throughout history that have used this as a negative example of Christianity. Anybody know who Julian the Apostate is? He certainly didn't go by Julian the Apostate at the time. Constantine, remember Constantine was the Roman emperor that got converted to Christianity? He didn't make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, though. He just said it's okay. He became Christian himself, and he tolerated Christianity. It wasn't until, I can't remember who it was, but it was in the 385s or something. It was half a century later that it was made the official religion of the Roman Empire. Well, the last in the line of emperors that came from Constantine's family was a fellow named Julian, and he was a philosopher. He's a brilliant man, well-read and learned. But one of the things he wanted to do was return Rome to its true founding values. He wanted to go back to the Constitution, like we say now, or go back to the founding fathers. Well, Julian wanted to return Rome to its former glory by going back to the values that the early Romans embraced. And those values did not include what? Christianity, right? He thought that atheism or polytheism or whatever, anything was better. In fact, he even did nice things for the Jews, because that was Judaism was an ancient religion. But he was not a fan of Christianity. He didn't persecute them, at least he didn't. I'm not saying there weren't persecutions, but it wasn't his idea to persecute them. But he said, look, and he was since he was from a line of Christians, and he was the last Roman emperor who was not a Christian, he became known as Julian the Apostate. But he said, look, you got this parable in Luke where this guy is a scoundrel, and he's being held up as a positive example. You cheat your boss, you cheat everybody, and you're that's a good example. Like, what kind of religion is that? And that was what Julian said, and others have said the same thing. There are written records going back hundreds and hundreds of years. I read one this morning from the 1400s, I think it was, where somebody was wrestling with this parable. How do we understand it? And how should we understand it as Christians? This is someone who was trying to get good out of it. It's probably the most discussed and most disputed of all of Jesus' parables, and it has been for many, many years, because it's tough. It's just tough, I think. It's there are things there that are not entirely clear. So today we're going to examine this parable for ourselves, and we'll try to, if you don't mind, try to forget the chapter break between chapter 15 and 16, see if maybe there can be a connection to chapter 15. And along the way, we'll consider some but not all of the possible interpretations. This, if you want to ever get a book that thoroughly considers the parables, get this book. Snodgrass considers just a sampling of the different interpretations that are out there. He's got 16 that he lists by name, by number and name, and that he goes through, comes to his own conclusions. But at least he's considering all these different things. There are more than 16. He's taking the 16 most, what he feels are most important and most significant. So that just gives you an idea of the thoughts that are out there about this particular parable. Let's start verse 1. It's the place to go. It says that he said unto his disciples, okay, so first of all, the audience is presumed to be his disciples. Some people will say, well, yeah, but you go down to verse 14, and it says the Pharisees were also nearby and they heard these things. Well, it's not, you don't know for sure if you're talking about they heard the things early in chapter 16 or later. We don't know. But at least it says at the beginning that the disciples were the audience. Now, the timing I mentioned before, this is during Jesus' last trip to Jerusalem from Galilee, when he knew he wasn't going to come back from this one. This was that last Passover in the time when he was crucified. So the term for that is the Lucan travel narrative. Excuse me. Now, I've mentioned to you before that much of the New Testament writings imitates, I guess, a good word, or follow the pattern of Old Testament writings in terms of how they're structured, and this is no exception. We have, what do we have, eight, if I'm going to assume there are eight verses in the parable, as Bailey does. We start with the rich man and the steward, and we end with the rich man and the steward, and it steps in. It's like this a parallelism that steps in. So in the first verse, we have an introduction to who's involved, and then we got a problem. The problem is stated in verse 2 and verse 3. He's fired, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. Then verse 4, that's where the idea comes, but verse 4 doesn't tell us what the idea is. But that's the center. That's the center of the structure. So what's that tell you? Center of the structure is where the most important thing is. That's where the action happens. That's where the plot develops or whatever. And then it comes back again to we had the problem in verses 2 and 3. Now in verses 5 and 6, we have the action plan. The parable does not tell us the action plan in verse 4. It gives us the action plan by letting us stand by as it develops in verses 5 and 6. And then in 7, the story. Now, this isn't the whole parable. I don't include verse 8, which is a summary. And then in verse 7, we come again. I mean, verse 8, I must have something missing. 1, 2, 3, 4, I can't count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Nope, I got something wrong here. 5, 6. Oh, you can figure this out. The way the verses come in, that's verse 8. Sorry. So verses 5, 6, and 7 are the action plan. Here we see it happening. And what happens, and then in verse 8, we come again to the rich man and the steward. This time, We find out that the steward is a rascal in verse 1. We get to verse 8, we find out he might be a rascal, but he's clever. He's smart, and there's something we can learn from him. And that's the difficult thing. What do we learn from a rascal? And that's what we'll talk about a little today. So there's the structure, the center of it being in verse 4 with the idea of what we're going to do. The rich man is, it just says here, a rich man, he has a steward. Any ideas? We've talked a lot about the context of the New Testament. Who would this rich man be? What kind of a person would he be in town? Anybody want to venture a guess there? Or you know? If you were sitting there in the audience, you would understand that this is a certain kind of person. Because of the debts, because of the nature of the debts, you'd know what kind of a person this was and what he did. He was a landowner. He was like a Boaz or somebody. He owned land. And how did it operate back in Palestine? Same way it operates in most of the world until very recently. You had a village, people lived in the village, and then the outlying lands were owned by different people who farmed it or paid people to farm it or let people be what we call in America, what are tenant farmers, sharecroppers, so who live there or allowed to live there in return for giving the owner of the land a portion of the crops, a portion of the profits. And that's a typical structure. So this guy, this rich man, was a landowner. And he had people that worked for him, either as sharecroppers, tenant farmers, you know, whether they lived there. That's an American thing, more or less. Typically, in a lot of other parts of the world, the people live in the village and go out to the farms. The people don't live on the farms. I can't tell you what matters here. It's just a story, but they would have understood it probably as these people all lived in the village and just worked the farms. So the rich man was a landowner. He had tenant farmers. Now, who accused? It doesn't say, but it just says here in verse 1, it says it was accused to this rich man that his steward had wasted his goods. Who was doing the accusations? I mean, there aren't no right or wrong answers here necessarily. I'm just trying to get you to think about it. If you were sitting there hearing the story when Jesus gave it as he came through your town, you probably, in your mind, had somebody in mind that in your town owned the land. You know, ever heard the Paul Simon song, Richard Corey? They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around, so on. Okay? So even in America, we've had this popular imagery of somebody who owns a lot and controls everything. And in any town throughout history, it's always been that way. Well, here you got a rich guy, and he owns the land. And when Jesus came through your town and gave this story, you can bet that there are people sitting there listening to the parable that are saying, just like old Boaz over here, you know. They had, and he's got this steward. I don't like this steward either, you know. So Jesus told stories that were accessible, right, that people could relate to. And a lot of the stories here in the book of Luke, and this is why a lot of people say this parable is about money. I'm not so sure. But a lot of them have to do with rich and poor. And Jesus seems to be, for the most part, on the side of the poor. Okay, and that also made his stories more accessible. And you know, the people he was reaching with the stories identified with his perspective. Excuse me. So this rich man obviously must have had some friends in town. Okay, the people that cared for him, thought he was an okay guy, and are saying, man, you know, your steward isn't on the up and up. You know, you really need to watch him. Now, I've heard he did this, or he did, you know, this is what somebody down, you know, somebody at the, I was going to say at the pub, I don't guess they have pubs, but whatever, at the square was saying about him. You know, words out that he did this or he did that. So somebody shared that. And the evidence must have been pretty strong, according to the story here. The master must have been respected. Now, if he was hated, just think, you know, think this through. Now, Jesus is painting a picture that's going to be very accessible to the people that are listening to it. If the landowner was despised, would somebody be looking out for him and saying, yeah, I think you got a bad steward? Probably not. Probably say, get more, you know, let me in on it. I don't like this guy. But he was apparently, or at least the picture, I can't say he was apparently because he's not a real person, but the picture that Jesus is painting is of a person who's respected in the community and kind of liked. Must be kind of nice or generous or something. Somehow or another, even though he's rich, he's not despised. All right? And we need to think about the community. All right, so Jesus is telling a story about a rich man and about a steward. But who's the third player in this story that's not mentioned?
The snitch.
Hmm?
The snitch, the guy that told.
Well, the steward. I'm sorry, the steward. Yeah, that's three. He's mentioned. You got the steward. I'm sorry. But who's a big player in this that's not mentioned in the story? Not a person, but many people. The community, the townspeople. The kind of people that Jesus is actually talking to. They're part of the story. Because some of them are telling the landowner that he's got a crook for a steward. And some of them are involved in other ways later on by implication. It's not written there. But if you were in the community listening to Jesus tell this story, you know. You know what is going on. You know what you would be doing if it happened in your town. Okay, those are the blanks that we want to fill in when we discuss this. All right, we got the steward, which you said Ron calls the crook. Now, in some of these 16 explanations, it kind of one of the ways that certain commentators have gotten around the idea that somehow this steward is being commended for being dishonest is they say, well, he's somehow involved in banking and his boss has charged interest or more interest than he should, and the steward's correcting it. And I don't think all that stuff washes. I think it's just trying to look for an excuse. But the words that are used here for steward are words that are normally used for estate managers, people who run the affairs of somebody who owns property, either runs the household or runs the entire operation, which may be lots of different farms. Lots of different plots of land. One guy's raising wheat, one guy's raising olives. You have different people doing different things. So he's got a lot of property. And in order to keep all that straight, he's got a trusted steward, probably a slave, maybe a freedman, don't know, but somebody who's probably been with him a long time and with whom he has placed his trust and who handles the affairs. And it says wasted. In King James, it says he was accused that he had wasted his goods. Really, that's in a, I don't know my grammar that well. It's in a present something. But it means he is wasting. He's in the process of wasting still. Was wasting, not that he just wasted. Like he didn't just make a mistake one time. He was in the process of doing this on a regular basis. That was his way of operating, was to cheat his master. Ongoing problem. And the master's friends or people in the town, whatever, for whatever reason, maybe to get in good with the master, wanted to let him know. So the steward wasn't the most popular guy in town. Wasn't even as popular as the boss, as the master. Okay, so we get to verse 2. It says he called him and he said to him, "How is it? What do I hear? What am I hearing about you?" And what is the answer?
He's wasting his goods.
Hmm? Well, no. How does the steward answer? He doesn't answer. He doesn't give an answer. If you're hearing this story, what does that tell you? Guilty. You know, he doesn't have an excuse. In fact, the boss, the master says, "What do I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you may no longer be steward." He's fired on the spot. The guy's already got enough evidence. He fires him on the spot and tells him, where it says, "Give an account of your stewardship," that doesn't mean I'm not a Greek scholar, I'm just telling you what I read. It doesn't mean you get a chance to go back and cook the books so that I don't see what you did. It means give me the books now. Well, he didn't have them. Apparently, he didn't have them with him. But you know, give me the books. You're fired. Hand over the keys. Okay, that's what happened. And the steward gives no explanation. No, you know, he could have done a lot of things, right? He could say, "Well, you know how these tenants are, boss. You know, they're just they're always doing that." Yeah, whatever. Please, you know. He didn't do that. There's all kinds of things he could have done, but the way Jesus tells the story here, he didn't do any of that. He's fired. He doesn't try to save his job. He doesn't give excuses. He doesn't give defense. He doesn't say, bring those people in here. See if, you know, they're just lying about me. See if they'll lie to me face to face. He doesn't say anything like that. He just says nothing because he knows he's caught. So there's no ambiguity there, the way the story is being told. The guy is guilty, and that's not an issue. He is a scoundrel. He is a rascal. He is a crook. Okay? That part is not in question at all. There are some of those 16 explanations that try to make excuse for him that somehow he's good, and that's why he gets commended. I believe the guy's a crook, and that he's not being commended for his crookedness. Okay. He doesn't make any excuses. He's basically admitting he's guilty. He's fired on the spot. You know, give an account means give me your books. You're done. Now, the thing that we need to understand, though, is that he's fired, but everybody else doesn't seem to know that. There's no evidence that anybody else knows that. By the way, I'll throw this in here now before I continue. The man gave no excuses in the story. That to me is a picture of, if we want to tie this in with chapter 15, that's a picture of us, right? We're sinners, right? We're sinners before God. And when we repent, we don't get on our knees and say, yeah, but I this and yeah, but that. We say, I'm sorry, I messed up. Now, this guy didn't do that, but the point is he's guilty and he didn't have an excuse. And in that sense, I think he's a picture of us. I don't know if any of those 16 say that, but it seems to me that he's a picture of us. You've got this merciful boss. The merciful boss didn't say, what could he have done? He fired him. That's bad enough. But what else could he have done? Had him arrested. Or if he's a slave, he could have been just without even, I would say he could be prosecuted, but if he's a slave, he doesn't even have to be prosecuted. Just throw him in jail. And the boss didn't do that. So the master's merciful. And that's a key, I think. The master's merciful, and the steward knows that. And he doesn't try to wheedle his way out of this, and he doesn't try to make excuses, and he doesn't defend himself. But he knows his boss is merciful because he's still standing there. He's not in jail. He hasn't been arrested. He hadn't been sold.
I was going to say, too, there must be, he didn't put him out right away, because otherwise he wouldn't have had time to speak to these other people.
Well, yeah, that's the next thing we're going to talk about. And that didn't happen. But I think the way the story again is told, I think he was fired right now. He just didn't have the books to give. The papers. He had to turn in the papers, but he must not have had them with him.
But he still gave him. I mean, he left him unattended, still on his
papers. Right. Which there, yeah, that's a good point. And it gave him the opportunity to do the other things he did. Very good. That's absolutely right. The boss. I don't know that the boss did that because he was merciful. You know, again, it's a story to illustrate a point. But he didn't kick him out on the street right then and there. He gave him time to get his affairs together. So the man's merciful, obviously. Now the steward, we get to verse 3. He states his problem. Right, he's talking to himself. We got a little soliloquy going here, and he says, "What am I going to do? I'm not going to be steward anymore. I'm fired. I cannot dig, and to beg I'm ashamed." Now, I didn't think this. I read this in one of the books. What's it mean, I cannot dig? I think, what, you're going to be a ditch digger? Did they have to have lots of ditches in that time? Huh?
That would be
manual work.
You might have been an
invalid. Well, I think one of the books pointed out had to do with farming, that you plow. They had very I showed you in one of the slides, they had primitive plows, you know, sticks or whatever. But there are areas that they wanted to cultivate that they couldn't get to with an ox and a plow. And for those, you had your slaves that dug by hand. So that's a likely, you know.
It might have been digging an orchard.
Yeah, all the farming. A lot of digging that goes on. Begging, he might have been too proud to beg, but also he wasn't the right class. He wasn't blind. He wasn't handicapped. He wasn't, you know, didn't have some disability. So I don't know that beggars were a common thing in that society. I say common, I don't know how common, but there was something that was expected. But you begged because you had a disability and people cared for you. You didn't beg just because you were too lazy to work. Times have changed a little bit, haven't they? Maybe they had people that did that then, but that it wasn't accepted. It wasn't acceptable. So that wasn't going to work. Now he says in verse 4, I'm resolved what to do. I figured it out so that when I'm put out of my stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he comes up with a plan. Bing, the light bulb goes off. He's got a plan. And really the plan is very clever. It's very, when you go through it, as we're going to just go through it here in a couple minutes, it's amazingly clever. And Jesus' audience would have got it. They would have got it. They would have understood things that we don't get right away. And I'm sharing some of this with you. A lot of what I'm sharing with you is from Bailey. I got two of his books up here, but Bailey, I've told you before, Kenneth Bailey, who lived in the Middle East for most of his life, and taught and studied the Bible there, and tried to understand the background of especially the parables and Jesus' teaching, and what's going on. How would the people that heard him have understood him? Because we live in such a different world now that that doesn't always mean the same to us. So I'll share with you some of his insights. Okay, so he's got a plan, and he needs a plan because he needs to work, and he needs to work in the same village. That's not an option. In that culture, you didn't just pick up roots like we do and say, "I'm going to move to Los Angeles because I've burned all my bridges around here." You couldn't do that then, because if you did move to Los Angeles, nobody knew you there, and you wouldn't even have a place to stay. So. He had to be able to find work in the same town, the same village. So he had to have a plan that somehow or another didn't irritate the master too much and yet left him popular enough that he could get another job. I think Jesus must have enjoyed sitting around thinking these stories up, because this one here seems to be complicated to me. And I didn't get it for years, and I was studying it in my regular Bible reading. I come through this thing, I think, this doesn't make sense to me. So I had to just read all I could about it and try to get some background, and I'm sharing some of that with you, whether I have it all right or not. At least I understand more about it now. It makes more sense. Because when I first read it, or read it again, it just didn't make sense. I had the same issues that everybody else has with it. Okay. He's got to stay popular. He wants another job. They don't tell us. It doesn't tell us what the solution is. We're just going to see it. And he's counting, as was said, he's counting on the generosity of his master, because he hasn't been put in jail. He does have an opportunity here to pull some shenanigans, as Christy pointed out. He's still got access to the books, and he can still do some stuff. So we read in the next verses what it is he's going to do. He called. What does that mean? Got on the horn, said, come on over. No. How would you call somebody in those days? No. I don't think so. He was a steward. He was a boss. He was at the top. He wasn't the owner, but he was at the top of the heap in his. So how did he call these guys?
Sent
a servant. So the servants were not aware that he'd been fired, as Christy says. They listened to him. He said, "Go get so and so." I said, "Sure, boss, I'll go get him." So again, the people hearing this story when Jesus is telling it understand this. The guy's been fired, but word's not out yet. So he's still got time. Maybe not a lot of time. Maybe he doesn't even know how much time he's got, but he's got some time. So he quick sends him out. What does it say, though? It says he sends out, how many at a time come back? One. He doesn't talk to them all at the same time. Why wouldn't you do that? Why do you want to get them individually? So they don't spread the news. They don't compare. They will spread sooner or later, but... You don't want them comparing notes. You don't want them, So you one-on-one, you work on them. So he's no dummy. He's very shrewd. It says he called. So there's two individuals at least, or two groups of individuals who don't know. One are the servants. They don't know he's been fired. And the people who are responding to the call don't know he's been fired because they show up. And when he speaks to them, what are they going to assume? He's still in charge, and he's speaking with the authority of the master, right? Is it out of the question that rates of tenants, the tenants would be renegotiated. Why could that possibly happen? What do you think? These people are farmers, right? Wheat, oil, who knows what else. They only give two examples since they called them all in. Why could you maybe renegotiate the rate or the payment?
Cash flow.
Maybe the boss needs more money. Okay. That's a very modern way of looking at it. Yeah, bad crop, bad year. Why? Could be a drought. Could be a locust plague. And the tenant's going to say, I can't pay you. I don't even, I'm not going to get any olives. How can I give you, so many denarii or whatever? So the idea that you might have to renegotiate the contract is totally, totally acceptable and totally expected at times. So you get called in, but there hasn't been a crisis. You get called in and the contract's renegotiated. Oh, and in your favor. Oh, okay. So it's a little different, but the fact that it's being renegotiated isn't something that would be unheard of. Of course, the guy says, what do you owe my master? Is that a rhetorical question? Yeah. I mean, he knows what they owe. That's his job. But what is he doing by asking them how much they owe? In modern terms, what would we call that? I don't think Jesus' time they use this term, but what do you call it when you ask them, oh, what do you owe? You're beginning the process of getting what? I don't know how to phrase this very well. Buy-in. These people are going to get involved in the spider's web a little bit. They might not know that's unjust and maybe illegal yet. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. We don't know what's being said, doesn't say. But they're getting drawn in. How much do you owe? Oh, well, write this. Okay. And then whose writing does it go in? Whose handwriting?
Theirs.
We think if you were them, you'd be a little suspicious by then? Maybe. But if somebody's offering you 500, the value of each of these reductions is 500 denarii. You remember denarii, that's the Roman coin that's supposed to be worth about a day's labor in the New Testament. So 500 of them, that's a year and a half's wages. This is no small change. But the value of both of these reductions is about 500 denarii. So they're not percentage-wise as to how big the contracts are, they're just the same amount, whatever that may or may not mean. So these are huge reductions, seemingly for no reason at all. But if somebody offers you, if you owe whatever, you owe 100 or something, and somebody says, I just woke up on the good side of the bed this morning and you only owe me 50, are you going to say, no, I'm not doing that? You say, yeah, where do I sign? I'll give you 50 right now, so whatever. You accept that. And these people accepted it. And they didn't have a reason not to. And it doesn't tell us, we don't have the detail to know whether they realized they were being sucked into something or not, but they were being spoken to individually, and they were writing something in their own handwriting. This kind of gives the steward an out, maybe, if he needs one. But we'll think about this some more. They are in a position now, if you're the guy who just got your debt reduced by 50%, are you going to complain about this steward anymore? Probably not. You're probably not going to complain about the master either if this all goes through. These are your two best friends. So it's pretty clever what's happened here. Everybody you've done this to is your new best buddy. So the steward's got a lot of best buddies now. They had no way of knowing he had been fired. Even if he told them, they have the opportunity or the ability to publicly deny it. I didn't know. They came, got me just like they always come and get me. How do I know? I just heard about it yesterday. I didn't know 2 days ago when I signed it. So you could get out of it. All right. Notice one other thing, and this gets back to what Christie said. He told them to sit down and to write 50, but how did he tell them to do it?
Quickly.
Yeah, that's probably right. You got to line up. We got to do this fast because word's going to get out that I've been fired. Now, he's not saying that, but he knows. So he said, quickly, you got to do this fast. He understood. He understood the matter of urgency. What?
It couldn't also be because he says, before I I change my mind?
They might think that, the people that are coming in, yeah. There's a certain matter of urgency here. We need to do this, we need to do it now. And everybody buys into it. These were enormous reductions. These weren't just, accounting errors or rounding errors or whatever. These are enormous adjustments. Now, you bring in two, you bring in three, four, whatever. What are they going to do? They're going to go back home, and it's in the village. It's just, they're going to walk for 2 minutes and they're going to be back home. And what are they going to do? Guess what? So-and-so called me in. And then you realize all of a sudden you're 500 denarii richer. So what do? You go down to the pub. I don't know. You celebrate. You toast the boss. You get out the good wine, whatever. You do something because it's party time. Not only you, but the guy over here and the guy over here and the guy that's got the guy that's got the olive grove and the guy that's doing the wheat. And they're all got reductions. And it's party time in the village. And who's the most popular guy in the village? Who do you think? Master, probably. And second most popular is the steward. And a good time was had by all. All right. Excuse me. If you're the master, what are you going to do now? What would you do? What could you do? Let's put it that way. What are your options? Huh? What? Rehired the steward. That bridge probably been crossed, but because of the shame and honor type culture, they probably it wouldn't be done. You've already fired him, you're going to fire him. I'm sorry.
He can't go back and change the changes.
Could he?
Legally?
Okay, so he has the option to go back and say, I fired this guy yesterday. He had no authority to do this, and you're going to pay what is on the contract. And the guy would go from being the most popular guy in town to being the devil, and right then and there. So as Christy says, no, he's not going to do that. They're all celebrating him. They're all toasting him as the best, best landowner ever. Better than the guy down at that village and the guy over at that village. Boy, I've heard some stories about him. This guy, give us this, So he's very popular. But he could again throw the steward in jail. He could do all kinds of things. What's the steward banking on? Banking on his master's mercy. His master's already been merciful, and he figures, I can get him again. He's still going to be merciful. And according to the story, he is. So it seems that the master just decides to bask in the popularity and eat it. Verse 8 says, then the Lord, the master, commended the unjust steward. Whoa, that's the part we have trouble with. All right, the guy just cheated him out of all this money. He lied, he stole, and he's commended. So Julian the Apostate says, these are your heroes. What kind of a religion is this? Let's go back to the good old heroes back in early Rome. Well, it could look like that at first blush. But the parable gives us a clue. It says he commended the unjust steward for he had done wisely. Okay. So there's a difference between I wrote this down so I wouldn't mess it up. he's not being commended for dishonesty. He's a dishonest man who has been commended for being clever. He's not a clever man who's being commended for being dishonest. Make sense? What is it he's being commended for? Well, it says, he has done wisely, for the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. So in the parable, Jesus is identifying him with the children of this age, not the children of light, but the children of darkness. So he's got, you know, there's no ambiguity as to whether this is a good guy or a bad guy. He's a bad guy, and Jesus says he's one of this world, okay? He's a bad guy. But it seems to me he's also saying we can even learn from the bad guys. This guy did something very clever. Not that he was dishonest, that wasn't the part, but he, what did he do? Well, I should ask you. What did he do that was clever?
Is there any reason to think that maybe these were foreclosure situations where the man was not going to get the money without foreclosing on the loan, and so they got 50%, that's why it was, because he got 50% of the debt in and cleared everything off.
I don't think there's anything in the text to say that. I don't know that his audience would have understood it to be that way, but I guess it's possible. I don't know.
Well, one thing Stewart did was he saved a situation from getting worse, because once word did get out that he was fired and why he was fired, the civilian, the workers are going to find out, wait a minute, I was cheated and stolen from and I've paid way too much. So he went ahead and got ahead of the curve and gave them the money back. That way the landowner saved face. He's a jolly good fellow, great guy. And the steward settled it all out before he left.
Okay, I think there's part truth to that. I'm not sure. I don't think the story tells us that there was a rip-off situation to start with. It may have been fair to start with. But certainly the master became popular through following through with it. I think it was clever too, because he realized he had to act quickly, and he did. He figured out a way to have everybody on his side when it was all said and done. I mean, yeah, it was dishonest, but it was very ingenious. You know, you got the master on your side, you got the steward, you know, you got all the people on your side, the whole village likes you and likes the master. The master can't get out of it any kind of way. It's just very clever. And again, it's not, you know, he's not being commended for being dishonest, but he's being commended, I think, for thinking this through and for taking action when he had the ability to do it, and for, given his world and the rules that govern his world, he did the best he could do. And verse 9, which I don't know that it's part of the, in verse 8, I'm sorry. It says, the children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of light. In other words, are we as clever with what we're given, with the rules and standards that are given to us, in accomplishing things as, are we as clever at that as somebody else that's a child of darkness, as Jesus would call them, as clever as they are at using their rules and their society to get what they need to have done? So it's kind of sticky in a way. I'm still not feeling really good about it, but I can see where the audience that Jesus is talking to, who very much relates to the tenant farmers and to the, you know, typically oppressed people, and they can see this story as one where everybody kind of benefits. And why do they benefit? Yes, this guy was shrewd, but they benefit really because of the mercy and the kindness of the master. And so perhaps, and this is what Bailey says, perhaps that's the main point of the parable. That this is a parable about, you know, God is merciful. And he's merciful regardless of what we do. Not that we should be dishonest and follow that. But he is merciful, and we should try to serve him the best we can. We should, you know, this fella, we say, when I said what was clever, he was very resourceful. He had a sense of urgency. I got to do this now. He was clever. These are not necessarily bad qualities. And perhaps, maybe that's Jesus' point in telling the story, and Luke's point, and this, he's the only gospel writer that included it. Maybe a part of his point of including it is that as Christians, we don't want to just say everything we observe in the world is just so bad and so wrong and so horrible. But see, this guy has some initiative. Even if it was in a crooked way, he had a sense of urgency, and he was very resourceful, and that those aren't bad things. We aren't to be dishonest like he is, but we are to be resourceful and clever, and, you know, have a sense of urgency when we need to. Okay, so I think I think that it's that if you wanted to end the parable at verse 8, it works, and that God is merciful, and that Christians have things they can learn. You know, we have things that we can learn from even those who don't follow the laws that we follow. In other words, another way of saying it is that Jesus used a rascal to illustrate a good trait. The good trait is not the fact that he was a rascal. He just used a rascal as the main character, or one of the main characters. Now, some people would say verses 9 to 13, and I'm not going to go through there, are explanations of the parable and parts of it. Some would say that they're separate. Some would say that verse 9 is part of the parable. If verse 9 is likely to, if it's a part of the parable, then when you read verse 9, it says, I say unto you, make yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, so that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting institutions. So what's this? Yeah. Habitation, sorry. Then that would give the understanding that the parable is about using the resources that we have wisely, just as the steward did. And that would, you know, that takes the focus off of the mercy of the master, if this is part of the parable. I can't tell you whether it is or it isn't. But I can say this. Either way works. Maybe both. Because they're both valid. Our master is very merciful. And we also are to make the best use of what talents and resources that God gives us. There is that tension in Scripture between, you know, sell everything you have and give to the poor, and make use of what God has given you, the talents he's given you. If everyone sold what they had and gave to the poor, then, you know, it's an old Monty Python sketch, the poor or the rich, and, you know, you get everything gets upside down. Yes?
Well, maybe the Lord commended the unjust steward, say, because he had done wisely. Maybe one of the reasons he commended him is because he turned a prophet.
He turned a prophet?
Right.
He made the best of a bad situation.
Since we're supposed to turn a profit, then maybe that's the one thing he did that was pretty commendable.
He didn't turn a profit for his master, though. I would say that's the difference. In the parable of the talents and pounds, we are to have a profit for our master, not for ourselves. So there might be a little difference there. But he certainly was productive.
Well, is it something better than nothing?
He was productive. He was productive in accomplishing something there. Yeah. Well, no, his boss would have gotten, the master would have gotten it all. He got a little less because of this work. But I think either way works. I think either way works. And I'm not going to stand up here and say I've got the answer, and the answer is the parable stops at verse 8, or that the answer is the parable stops at verse 9. I'm just telling you, I don't know. But either way works, because either lesson is valid. It's also important, I think, to remember when we look at parables, Jesus was an itinerant teacher. That means he went from town to town to town, telling the same stories over and over and over again. If he's anything like I am, or any of you that have spoken in public, we tend to tailor our presentations to the audience that we're giving it to. You know, Dan teaches square dancing. He can't do it the same way to a group that's never seen a square dance before as he does to experienced square dancers. You have to tailor your presentation to the knowledge of the group that you're giving it to, and you tailor it to their geography, their culture, their village. You know, another possible explanation, you know, when Luke's putting things together, he's getting stories that have been passed down to him. He wasn't there, and they can take different forms, and he blends them together. So that can sometimes, perhaps anyway, explain what might seem to be discrepancies in parables or so forth, when you realize Jesus told them dozens of times and didn't always, I can't assume that he would always tell it exactly the same way. That wouldn't make sense. Yes, that's one of the, I meant to point that out if I didn't make it clear, that some would say that these verses from 9 to 13 are explanations of the parable. Whether they, and there's others that say, well, this is just a separate, if I was going to actually mention that in a minute, that there's a separate poem or separate set of sayings that Luke put there that stand on their own. I don't know the answer to that. Could be. I don't know how you could prove it one way or the other.
Not to be a too much interjection, but is it possible it's an object lesson because we're told that the called are not the wise of the world, and the meek, and the person is not necessarily the mover and shaker in the town, and the object here being is, you know, you need to, you know, you are called, but you don't sit back. You know, you have the ability and are commended to use your wit.
I think so. To me, that's probably the main point. You know, the children of this age, this world, the ones that Jesus is saying, people that aren't called and don't know what, you know, God is doing in the world are better at dealing with the resources they have than we are with the resources we have. And it seems to be an encouragement to, pick it up a notch and do better with what you have. And Hughes talked about this before with the talents. You know, that God has given certain things. He didn't give them to us not to use them and not to be energetic, urgent, and even perhaps clever in how we use them. Not dishonest, but at least a certain extent clever. No, I agree. So I think either interpretation works, or maybe a combination of both. In either case, Julian the Apostate is not correct. It's not an encouragement to become a scoundrel or a rascal at all. It's an encouragement to learn even from a scoundrel. The Proverbs say there's wisdom out in the streets, and it cries to us, right? Wisdom is available everywhere, even from a scoundrel. So don't be afraid to learn from wherever wisdom cries out, even if wisdom is crying out from a rascal.